IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. China's passed a new National Coast Guard law. Now, Coast Guards might not necessarily be something that all of us associate with military escalation, but there's some things in this new law that have a lot of potential for some pretty crisis-like events in the South China Sea. Suyash Desai, who is one of our top China research analysts, has written about this in an op-ed in the Deccan Herald recently, which we will link in the description of this podcast, of course. But what we're going to do in this podcast is have a general discussion about what this law says, what kind of ambiguities are in the law, and what those ambiguities might lead to realistically in the highly politically and militarily charged region of the South China Sea and its periphery, which is something that could potentially involve a whole bunch of nations, including India as well. So let's get straight to it. Welcome, Suyash, to the podcast.
Thanks, Anirudh. Thank you for having me.
So let's begin by talking a little bit about what is in this new National Coast Guard law. What kind of provisions does it have? What kind of jurisdiction does it lay out?
Okay, so this Coast Guard law was passed in National People's Congress Standing Committee in the third week of January. I think it was around 21st or 22nd of January. This law has been under discussion for quite some time. I remember for the past 6 months, there have been debates and discussion in the world and also in China regarding this law. So what does this law enables China's Coast Guard is that it enables them to operate in the contested waters, which they were already doing. It enables them to open fire in the contested water. And also, there are different ways in which they can fire. There are different tools which they can use for firing: handheld tools, shipborne tools, and airborne tools. I'll focus on these three later in the episode, but just remember these three things: handheld, shipborne, and airborne tools. They can also demolish other countries' structure. Now, this is something very escalatory because China claims a lot of region around its periphery. They can demolish other countries' structure built on Chinese, quote-unquote, Chinese claimed reef. They can board and inspect foreign vessels. They can create, so if any vessel is operating in Chinese claimed waters, it can board that vessel and inspect that vessel. It can create temporary exclusion zone. As we have seen, they have already created a lot of temporary exclusion zone near Philippines, when especially during the fishing season, which have an escalatory potential in the South China Sea. And they can use this at the discretion of their own. So they don't, all this is now under the domestic law, which enables and empowers them to do this without fearing the consequence of international law. Not that they give a lot of importance or credibility to international law per se, but now the domestic law is backing these provisions, which make this even more dangerous and escalating in the future. These are the broad things that the law encompasses. Now, I told you in the start itself that you have to focus on these three terms: handheld weapon, shipborne weapon, and airborne weapon. This is something unique because, again, this has an escalatory potential. Handheld weapons can be something which, just giving a vague analogy, India and China were fighting on China's western border in Tibet. So India and China used a lot of handheld weapons. And handheld weapons can also be categorized as shooting guns or water cannons. Shipborne vessels are something that can be from ship to ship, surface to surface. Airborne weapons can be from planes to surface, air to surface, air to air. So they have defined these three terms. They have mentioned these three terms, but not defined these three terms, making it even more problematic for the region. So now their law is enabling them to use these three types of weapons, which will make this even more dangerous place to operate in the future.
Okay, this is really fascinating. There's like a whole bunch of things that just logically speaking, given what we know about China's behavioral proclivities and the way that it tends to bully its neighboring countries in the South China Sea, it's very easy to think about like what this could potentially lead to, right? In the first place, if you're saying that if there's anything that is within Chinese claimed territories, and let's keep in mind that these Chinese claimed territories include what, about 2,000 square kilometers, Yash?
Correct.
In the South China Sea?
Correct.
That's a ridiculous amount of territory. And you're saying that anything that has been built there, whether or not it's internationally recognized as Chinese territory, we will go and demolish something there.
Correct.
Is profoundly worrisome. And then what you mentioned a little earlier about the fishing season, for example, basically gives China all the more reason to essentially go and pick a fight with perfectly innocent fishermen or perhaps coast guard vessels of another country and basically use that to justify even more aggression going forward. Well, in keeping with broadly what we have seen over the last few years in terms of China becoming increasingly belligerent and pugilistic about its territorial disputes, right? They are no longer willing to abide by international law or international convention even. They just are essentially daring the world in a way to come and lay down the law, which is not going to happen. So obviously what is going to happen is that individual countries are going to try and take it upon themselves to have a face-off with China, similar to what India has been doing, and dare China to end return escalated even further. So that's not going to be a pretty situation in the years to come. But one thing I want to specifically talk about, Suyash, are this is the process of how this bill came about. You mentioned in your op-ed that initially the draft was fairly clear about what the jurisdiction of the law is going to be. It was fairly clear about who was allowed to take judgment calls about various incidents that might happen in the course of Coast Guard patrols. And it was also fairly clear about what kind of weapons can be used, how these weapons can be used. But that is not the case in the current draft of the law. Is that right?
Correct, Anirudh. So there are a lot of ambiguities. I thought that it would be important that we highlight three ambiguities which have a potential, which can act as a tinderbox in the future. First, as you've already stated regarding the interpretation of law. So initially, this is the third draft which has been converted into the law. The first two drafts had a provision, had definitions of jurisdictional water. So generally, in any country's Coast Guard law, the territory in which they could operate is generally called as jurisdictional water. Previous draft stated that, if I remember correctly, internal seas, territorial seas, continuous zone, exclusive economic zone, continental shelf, and other waters under the People's Republic of China. So yes, other waters include the South China Sea, but generally they had kept it well defined, as in where can these coast guards can operate. This is broadly referred to as internal seas. But now in the latest draft, which is ratified into a law, they have just mentioned that they have removed all this and they have said that in Chinese claimed water under Chinese jurisdiction. So this is very ambiguous because we don't know what is, according to us, if we apply Yun clause, then water under Chinese jurisdiction is only 12 kilometers and the next EEZ, where generally is the norm that Coast Guard operates. But according to China, water under their jurisdiction is almost 80 to 90% of the South China Sea, 30 to 40% of East China Sea, the entire Yellow Sea, half or more than that of Taiwan Strait. This increases the scope of operation of Chinese Coast Guard's jurisdiction.
That is crazy, Suyash. So you're basically saying that the Chinese have written for themselves a carte blanche saying we can do whatever we want in this territory and it's totally fine by us and it's totally legal and the entire government apparatus is going to stand behind it. One thing that I find striking is that you said that this was tweaked in the final bill that was actually passed, right? And given how quote-unquote democratic the Chinese parliament is, we can imagine that this was not because of some conscientious objection that was introduced by some parliamentarian. Instead, it must have been obviously a reaction to some kind of global pressure that China is feeling that has led to the law being made something that's more belligerent. So do you have any ideas or thoughts as to why this is happening? What is the China responding to that has made it adopt such a confrontational stance in this law?
Correct. So, Anirudh, just replying to what you have said, so there is a history behind this law. If you even remove what they are seeing in the current draft, Chinese coast guards still operated in this region. though their operation was limited because a lot of work was done by their maritime militia, which is very different from Coast Guard. So maritime militias are militias basically. Coast Guards come under the paramilitary forces. So a lot of groundwork or the dirty work was done by militia, but also Coast Guards operated in this region. But there were a lot of complaints from Coast Guard, and this is only printed in the Chinese press, this is not in the English press, regarding the trouble they used to face while operating in this region because of obviously contestations with different navies. So Philippines have also passed such a law because they didn't want to hold their Coast Guards back. So that's why the problems that they faced were being taken up to the NPC, and that is why they have just empowered the Coast Guard by passing this law. Now under this law, they will be legally protected under the Chinese system to do all the things that they are doing in the South China Sea previously. Previously, they were not legally protected. And as we have seen, so UN clause or any international treaty is not obligatory to anyone. Most often than other occasions, the national law thrives over the international law. That is because pure realist tendencies where they consider the national law, territorial law more important than the international law. So this law enables them, empowers them with the legal protection. That is the only difference from what it is. So we can assume in the future that due to the legal protection, their activities are going to increase in the future. So that is the one basic interpretation that we can come out due to this law.
Interesting.
Yeah. So there are a few other ambiguities on the road. So two other ambiguities are very striking regarding this law. One regarding the use of firearms. In the previous draft, the draft read something like this, that you can use a firearm by giving a warning, only after giving a warning. So for example, if you and I are coast guards of different countries and we are in a contestation, we are in a face-off, I should first warn you by firing in the air and then only I can use a firearm. But now they have removed that provision. That implies that it is completely left to the interpretation of the Coast Guard on how to use the firearm. So I can fire it, I can warn it, or I can use it on you. So this makes this even more escalated because there are two type of officers. One is the dovish one, one is the hawkish one. If it is a dovish Coast Guard, then it's fine. He will definitely use it. And it is not only related to China. It is in general. It can happen with India. It can happen with Philippines. It can happen with the US. And considering that people are more dovish than hawkish and following a basic procedure, operational procedures which are being laid down, first fire would be in the air and second would be for warning them. But now if it is legally being taken out, then in 1 out of 100 cases, there can be a hawkish officer who can fire on the vessel instead of firing in air. So this has an escalatory potential. Just while speaking about this, the thought came to my mind regarding the General YK Joshi's interview, which is making a lot of round on India-China border, where he specifically said that the military tendency is such, when India went to take positions on Kailash Range and on 29th and 30th of the August, when PLA started coming up, there was a chance where it could have turned into a war if Indians would have fired back. But operational procedures were being followed and air firing was done. People didn't fire on each other. Now think of it in the South China context. This operational procedures are being taken out of law. Though I'm sure they are in practice, but because they are taken out of law, it might be difficult to follow them, making this region even more escalated.
That's a very interesting point, Siyashin. I mean, pardon me if I'm being a little hawkish on China at this point, but it seems to me that if you're going to leave this gaping hole in your legal procedures, then you're essentially making it a lot easier for hawks to get away with whatever they want to do. So let's say there's some Enthu Cutlet officer who is driven by patriotism towards the motherland and is genuinely convinced that he must defeat the enemies of the glorious Chinese nation by firing his gun at their ship. And he does that because he knows that the law has left that room for him. Then it doesn't matter at all what is being done in practice, because as soon as you have a single violation, all the convention, everything is thrown out of the window. If somebody genuinely believes that they are not going to face any legal consequences, in fact, if the legal provisions don't even exist to ensure that a particular kind of behavior is enforced, especially in such a highly sensitive and highly critical region, then you're basically clearing the way for some very serious escalation in the years to come.
Correct. And so let us be dovish ourselves and say that 99 out of 100 times the potential for accident is less because of our standard operating procedures which are being laid down by the armed forces. But that 1 out of 100 time, the one time where this person, hawkish person, chooses to not follow the standard operating procedure, this can lead to a domino effect where one accident can lead to another because of the region where so many regional and extra-regional actors are operating at the same time.
I mean, I will just say that look at the way that Chinese diplomats whose job is to make other countries feel good about China, how belligerently they pursue their roles on Twitter, right? So it's a little difficult for me to also extend the same kind judgment as you have to their officers, Suyash. But moving on, you said there was another ambiguity in the law that is very interesting. So what is that ambiguity?
That is a related ambiguity. So in the previous draft, they said that while firing, you should fire below the waterline. So waterline is basically a line on a vessel. So first you're firing in the air, then you're warning someone by firing below the waterline, a line on a vessel below which you should fire, and then you should fire. Whether it's a water gun, whether it's any harpoon or whether it's anything, then you should fire to the third procedure would be, or third or fourth procedure would be firing on that vessel. So first is air, second is waterline. Now they have removed that. Again, left to the interpretation of Coast Guard, I am assuming that. But removing that just... it's like unleashing a tiger. If you remove the leash, he can do whatever he wants, which can have an escalatory potential in the future, considering a region to be a hotspot of geopolitical activities in the Western Pacific Ocean. So that is a related point which can turn out to be dangerous in the future. Not that these procedures were thoroughly practiced in the past, but just empowering this law empowers the Coast Guard to do it officially with a legal backing.
Exactly. And I think the metaphor that you used of unleashing the tiger is very powerful, Suyash, because essentially there's a signal, right? What the Chinese are trying to say is that, look, by putting this law out there, we are saying that our Coast Guards can do whatever they want, and we are going to back them up with whatever we have. So basically, we dare you to push us and see what happens. The very fact that this law has come out here, even before any escalatory events have actually happened, is in itself a very clear signal to the international community, and in itself, I think, somewhat escalatory in nature.
Correct. That's a good point that you made, Anirudh. It's more of a signaling that we are going to continue all the activities that we are doing from past, especially in 2020. And if you try to encroach our territory, if you try to push us, which the US is trying to do, especially with the change of its South China Sea approach since July 2020, we would even consider firing, which would have an escalatory potential. This is a very powerful signal coming out of China due to this law.
And good to see that China is, as always, being a sober and responsible and peacefully rising member of the international community. But let's try to explore this point of escalation a little further here. So we've talked about escalation so far in a very general sense, right? But in a more specific sense, given all the other like clashing maritime economic boundaries that are there in and around the South China Sea, given the fact that so many countries have trade routes, energy supplies, and even military patrols that go through the region, what exactly do you see happening in the years and months to come? What do we mean when we say escalatory potential? What kind of effects is this going to have on the South China Sea and its periphery?
So we can divide this into two points. One, by we can gaze by looking at how the regional and extra-regional stakeholders have reacted to it. And two, we can just lay out conventional escalatory incidents or accident that can have a larger implication on the region. So the prior one, Philippines have obviously said that this law is not going to work. But there is an irony in that because Philippines have themselves enacted such a law in 2018, where they have empowered their coast guards to use firearms if needed. But there is a difference between Philippines using the firearms because they will use in their jurisdiction, and China using the firearms because China will use it in the South China Sea, which is not their jurisdiction, but they claim to be their jurisdiction. Vietnam has reacted to this law because these are again stakeholders. So basically Vietnam, Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines, even Taiwan up to an extent, these are the stakeholders in the South China Sea, and it was obvious that these countries would react to such a law. US being an extra-regional stakeholder in the sea because of the FONOPS that it is doing has reacted, and both the regimes, not only the ongoing President Biden's regime, but previously under Donald Trump, President Donald Trump, his foreign minister, that is the Secretary of State, which was ill-famous for reacting harshly, reacted as he does always. But similar reactions, the world is seeing similar reactions from Antony Blinken, who is the Secretary of State for President Biden. Similar aggressive reactions from him regarding China's law. But these were the usual candidates, the regional and extra-regional stakeholders. Even France has reacted to this. Recently, I read somewhere, unable to recollect where, but French submarine was operating within the region after the law was passed. The UK has reacted to this. UK has made some statements because it definitely has an escalatory potential which will impact all of them. It will impact the regional stakeholders because they are in the region. It will directly impact their security. It will impact US because they are in the region. But all others, because South China Sea is one third of the trading, because a lot of trading happens. And if there is an escalation, it will impact all trading nations in general. So that's why regional, extra-regional and others being France and UK have reacted to this law. Now, if I'm allowed to lay out what can happen, in normal maritime conflict, these are common practices which could lead to an accident. For instance, if someone fires unknowingly, it can lead to an escalation, which can lead to a reaction of other countries getting involved. For example, if a Chinese Coast Guard fires on a Philippines Coast Guard, then US can come into the picture because they have a mutual treaty. Though it will not happen generally, but it can happen in the future. There are certain provisions in the law where operational jurisdiction has been expanded. So if there is an accident between a Chinese vessel and a US vessel, if there is an accident between a Chinese vessel and a Japanese vessel, it can escalate into bigger events. If no deployment zone is created, no inter zone is created by the Chinese Coast Guards, and if US enters that, then it can have an escalatory potential. Not as much as accidents, but yes, it will definitely have an escalatory potential. Already we have seen in 2020 that a lot of testing, missiles testing has taken place in the region, and the region has really become a hotspot due to increased Chinese aggression on all its border, including South China, on all its periphery, including South China Sea. So yes, these three reasons primarily could lead to a larger escalatory nature of conflict, where not only regional but extra-regional stakeholders can get involved into it. Extra-regional stakeholder primary being the US.
That's all absolutely fascinating, Suyash. And it never ceases to amaze me that a regime like that of the Chinese Communist Party has somehow managed to get away with all it has over the last few years. Like, especially like seeing its activities in the South China Sea within the context of all the other things it does, such as, for example, what the United Nations also calls now the genocide of Uyghurs in Xinjiang province. What we observing from India know there has been a cultural genocide in Tibet as well. And now you have them essentially daring the international community to go to war with them. And it just amazes me that business is still done with this state, even despite all indications that it does not see itself as being an equal member of an international community of humanity, but rather essentially an empire that can do whatever it wants.
So if I can add one point, Anirudh, so what's the underlying theme in international relations? Power thrives everything. Well, if you have power, you are open to do everything. No one can challenge you. That is what China has proved to us, which is what the United States did in the past century.
I would like to believe that in the 21st century, we can be somewhat more enlightened, but apparently not. On that note, before we conclude, though, I'd just briefly like to say that we have a really interesting event that is lined up at Takshashila this Friday. So at 5:30 p.m., a bunch of our alumni, including Gaurav Jabali, a friend of mine who was an alumnus of our strategic studies program, is going to be speaking with Mohammad Zeeshan. Mohammad Zeeshan is the founding partner and editor-in-chief of the Freedom Gazette, and his book, Flying Blind, is a really interesting take on the various foreign policy challenges that India faces today, our less than stellar record in dealing with the foreign policy records of the 20th century, and the potential niche that exists for India to play a role in global governance in the years to come. So I'm sure it's going to be a fascinating event. A whole bunch of us are going to be there. So if you enjoyed this episode and if you're interested in how India could potentially counterbalance China's activities on the international stage, for example, then I highly recommend that you go and check it out. There will be a link to Suyash's op-ed on this new Coast Guard law, as well as a link to register for the event in the description of this podcast. On that note, thank you so much for joining us, Suyash, and thank you all for listening to All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is at IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle at TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.